Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 207 with the title, Inclusion Through Play. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome Nikki Forster. Nikki is a learning and development specialist who challenges traditional training by designing playful, inclusive experiences that help everyone feel they truly belong. When I asked Nikki to describe her superpower, she just said it is her ability to turn almost anything into an engaging, inclusive learning experience that meets people exactly where they are. Hello, Nikki. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for having me along today.
Pleasure. We met probably back in October, September at a local business coaching workshop series that was being run in the local council offices, is that right? Something like that?
We did, yes. I think you were part of cohort two. I came along as part of cohort one, and the lady who was running asked me to come back and do a specific piece around managing people. And I racked my brains as to how to do that, where it wasn't just, you know, words on a PowerPoint slide. And I think we engaged over that little session.
Yeah, we did. And my wife, Marie, was with us as well. And she's not normally one to participate in these kind of stand-up activity games. She's always one at the back. She's the introvert, don't make me stand up, don't make me clap, don't make me put my hand in the room. And even she engaged, and I was really impressed. We built little Lego models, didn't we? And you gave us a box of Lego each. We played with it, little cars to look at, and design our cars, I think it was. And I think the way you did it was you built it up really, really slowly, that we bought into the concept. So we were invested in the vehicle. And then he said, right now, I want you to stand up and put the vehicle on the mat where it represents where you're at right now. And of course, you've already got the investment in it. It's a very small gap to go from vehicle in front of you to vehicle on the mat, isn't it?
And yeah, I thought that was a very, very good technique. It's wonderful watching people, you know, kind of also different in what people made and what people's ideas are. And I think that that's part of what draws me to that style of facilitation is allowing people very much to be themselves and not just be the loudest person in the room that wants, you know, that is able to express themselves there and then. It's about everybody being able to think first and then participate.
I'm guessing that you bespoked the whole game, if you like, the game, the cards. You had a deck of cards, which we handed out. You had a mat, which I'm presuming you designed or at least assembled from some templates and things. But
It's kind of a bit of a mishmash of things. So very much some of the tools that I were using were ones that I've made specifically to use in a training arena. But some of the other elements, like using the Lego, part of that is just learning and development, but it also comes from something called Lego Serious Play, which I do a lot of as well. It uses Lego in a slightly different way to how we were using it, but ultimately is about that interaction and getting people to create things for themselves.
Over COVID, I did a few Minecraft events. So again, I guess digging and building in Minecraft and having a little project team and a project leader to decide how you're going to excavate or build or construct and achieve goals. I guess in Minecraft, it's just a digital version of Lego play, is it?
kind of using Lego in Lego. So I think I probably just need to distinguish, because if you've got anybody in your audience who knows about Lego serious play and I start talking about Lego as in we're just building stuff, that you'll probably get some emails. So because they're quite distinct. So I use it in two different ways. In the way that you're talking about and the way in which we used it, it was very much using Lego as a tool to be able to start a discussion. And so that's how we used it. Lego Serious Play is an actual methodology created by the Lego group back in the 90s, along with two professors. And they created something that has a specific methodology where everybody builds their answer, shares their answer, so everybody in the room gets to hear it. And then you can bring all those models together to create a much bigger narrative, a much bigger model. And so it has very many different layers to it. So depending on what I'm doing will depend on which of those is the best option to use.
So I'm assuming that Lego Serious Play then is a trademarked program, and you have to be a certified or part of the Lego clan to be able to use it. Is that right?
Ooh, okay. So this is where it gets interesting. So the first part of your question, yes, it is trademarked. You have to have your little R's in circles. Are they, what are they called? Registered trademark.
Yeah.
So if you write in Lego Serious Play down, it has to be down that, and it is associated with Lego. However, they did a really interesting thing. So they started off with it, training people to use it and running certification courses. So because it was originally designed for in-house. Because if you think in the mid-90s, you were just talking about Minecraft there. In the mid-90s, that's a lot of when the kind of electrical games came out. A lot of gaming and stuff was becoming big. And Lego was at that stage where they're going, oh, okay, how do we keep up with this? You know, we're just a little traditional blocks and things. What do we do? So that's when they collaborated with these two professors to go, surely there's something that we can use in-house that we can spark ideas and conversations with our teams in order to work out what our future is, the strategy. So that's where Lego Serious Play started. Then they realized, actually, other businesses could benefit from this. So they started training people. But in 2010, they made the decision to make it what's called open source, which is basically, here's all the details. Here's how you run it. As long as you know how to facilitate, go ahead and do it. And so you don't have to be certified. And it's one of my big bugbears. I can rant about this for quite a while, but I won't. But when I see people offering Lego Serious Play certification courses, that's fine if you're not in learning development, you're not a trainer, you're not a facilitator, and you're learning from scratch. I think it's a good route to go down. But what they're really teaching you is how to facilitate and using Lego Serious Play as the underlying method for it. So I run courses for experienced trainers, facilitators, coaches and educators about how to use Lego Serious Play. And it's a one-day event. You don't have to be certified to do it. So I did go off on a rant there, sorry.
No, that's fine. It's education. I've learned something. That's good.
But I think ultimately it should always be about the learner and not about whose model it's attributed to or the theory. Unless you're using that throughout an entire program, it should always be about, well, what's useful for the learner? How am I going to get the learners to feel comfortable in the space and open up and engage? And if that means using Lego, then fantastic, let's do that.
And drilling down into that, it's about each individual learner, not the cohort of learners, because we've got to be multimodal. We've got to think about each learning style, each attention style, each reward,
yes,
pathway, all these kind of things. And too often, it's a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, I remember a little while ago, but I remember it quite vividly. I went along to a training event and I was writing my notes. I'm not a copious note taker, but I do like making just notes or scribbling down things or doodling or something like that. And I was actually told by the trainer to stop writing. Yeah. And it took me a moment stop writing. You have to listen. That's how you're going to learn. You have to listen. Well, you're not much of a trainer if that's what you think. And I didn't say that out loud. That was in my head. But it took me a while, and I'm not normally a person that's lost for words. But the idea that everybody has to learn in the same way, I think anybody who's worth their salt as a, you know, in learning and development understands that. However, not everybody does. Some people are very focused on, well, this is how I learn, so that's how I'm going to train or teach. So yes, I think it's really important to understand, and not just to design in that way, so have a workshop where all of that is incorporated, but to actually be very much in the moment of, this isn't landing, what do I do differently? Or, this is going great, let's do it a bit more, but that person over there isn't quite engaging. So, you know, it's very much around that for me. It's being in the moment and making sure that everybody's getting what they need or want. I do quite a lot of stuff pre-workshop, actually, when I'm running a program or working with clients, in order to understand who's turning up and what their needs are. And I think that's really helpful, not just from my perspective of understanding who's coming into the room, but I tend to send a form with a video attached to it, so they get to see me before they turn up. They get to understand a little bit about how the program's going to run, because I'm quite informal in the way that I do things, but everything has a purpose. So I think if people understand all of that up front, they can make better judgments when they turn up about how they might want to interact.
I remember seeing in the old days, yes, Steve Jobs at Apple.
Yeah.
And he was very famous for his launch and the way he stagecraft everything. I'm not sure the exact point I'm trying to make here, but I think what he did was, he used to do his presentations into like 8 minute or 10 minute segments. So we would talk for a while, then he flipped to a video, and the video would flip to a live demonstration, and then that would flip to involving somebody else come in and they talk about it and have a discussion, and then he'd move on to the next thing. So I've always taken that when I'm delivering training, delivering anything, I want to go through this cycle where I say, here's my 20-minute segment. I'm going to talk, I'm going to video, we're going to discuss, we're going to write something down, and then we're going to do some Q&A, and then we're going to rinse and repeat, do the next topic.
Yeah. And it's really keeping fluid, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. And now I've got a puppy, I've learned even more about those kind of techniques where you're constantly trying to feed the brain and move from one state to another state before the person shows the teeth and starts growling it.
Yes. Yeah. It is. It's about, I think at the kind of the real depth of it is psychology rather than anything else. It's about understanding people. And I think a lot of what I do, regardless of the topic that I'm training, it nearly always comes back to understanding yourself and understanding others. Everything else on top of that is just extra information that you can sprinkle over and go, and I'm going to use that in order to do this. But I think self-awareness, whether that's innate or whether you have to learn it, is the first step. And then understanding others and how you react to them is the bit that will then get you those, that kind of better interaction.
Those are, what you just said there, are the key tenets of emotional intelligence, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think you can learn it. I would say myself that I have learnt self-awareness, self-management, building relationships, all the tenets of those emotional intelligence there over the last 10, 15 years. Before that, I was unaware of who I was, how I showed up.
Yeah.
And I was unaware what if that mattered or not. So I think, yes, you can. I think you put people in a space where they go, the light bulb comes on and go, ah, okay, the world is much simpler if I understand who I am.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting to think about how we get to that point of self-awareness. And I do think some people have more insight than others naturally. But like we just said, I think it can also be learnt. And I think there are aspects that you can do yourself in order to learn that, but there are aspects that other people can help you with as well. So, yeah, simple things like, years and years ago, I did my first personality profiling, you know, the thing where you find out what your colours are and the stuff, and then what that means, and then whether you like the results of that or not. So that, I think, was probably my first journey into it. But I had some very good managers when I was younger, particularly starting out in my training career, who were more coaching managers, which worked well for me to a certain level, although I'm quite a pragmatist at heart. So I like to be involved, and I like for me to have an opinion But ultimately, I need to know why. Why are you asking me that? Why am I doing it this way? And so the managers that I had at the time understood that about me and was able to help me find my own way, encourage me to be the me that I am now in terms of, yes, you know, I do turn up with suitcases full of props in my training sessions. And I always have to a certain extent, but I think in those early years when I was, my world of training was experience was more about sitting in a room and seeing people talk at you. It was more of a presentation or a lecture. And so that was my experience of being trained.
I've got this content and you're going to have it.
Yes. Exactly. And I'm the expert on it. And, you know, you have to ask me the questions. So when you have an experience that you then think, well, I don't want to do it that way. And is that okay? You need that encouragement. You need people to go, yes, it's all right to do things differently. And I was very lucky that I had that.
Yeah. I tend to always assume that somebody in the room probably knows more than I do about the topic. So I never want to consider myself the expert. I'm just there. Yeah. I often say when I start talking is that I'm not here to tell you what to say, think or do. I'm just asking you to think about what you want to say, think or do. And I always have this, the acronym WIFM, WIIFM, you know, what's in it for me? So I'm always thinking about why the person's in the room, what they're hoping to get out of it. I really want to hear why they're there and what they're expecting. So
yes.
If I'm talking about this and everybody else in the room wants to talk about that, then I need to adjust. I can't force them to my side of the fence. I need to meet them where they are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's very much when you treat people like adults, but you're telling them that you're treating them like adults, I think you get a much better response. Again, you know, kind of having, I'm not a great delegate in workshops because I sit there and I go, why are you doing that? And I just want to redesign everything. But one of the things that I really struggle with is when people open up a workshop and they say things like, right, everybody has to switch their phone off. Or even worse, here's a bowl in the middle of the table. Everybody put your phones in there because I don't want you to be distracted. Or that's just treating them like a five-year-old. Not that five-year-olds have phones. Well, they might do. But, you know, it's like everybody's busy. If you need to use your phone, you use your phone, but just be considerate. I don't even mention phones, I have to be honest, because I think setting the expectation for people about we're all adults in the room. Nobody is, you know, saying that you have to be here. Nobody is saying that you have to participate. But when you do it with consideration for others, and we do it with respect and things like that. Yeah, so I think setting expectations is important, but doing it as an adult is even more.
Yeah, I tend to try and start with an expectations contract, if you like, where we put on a whiteboard. Yes. So what do we expect of each other today? Being present, be attentive.
Yeah.
Create a space for learning. Don't jump to conclusions. Allow people to have their opinions or those sort of things. So I would try and do it that way. And that's why I say to be present is kind of my way of saying, if you could turn your notifications off, silence the thing. But I also, if you need to make a phone call, you're busy. You want to make a phone call, please step out. Go and go to the toilet when you want. Use the phone when you want, but do it outside the room.
Absolutely.
I ran a workshop a little while ago, probably a year ago. And I think it was the chief people officer was in the room. And they constantly were sat there on the laptop going, tick, 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 tick. And then their phone was beep, 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 beep. All the other delegates were going, this person's supposed to be setting an example here. And I felt really, really uncomfortable because I could feel everybody else was uncomfortable. And I didn't want to sort of say, oi, you, stop it. But I was all, and they were looking to me as, again, you know, because you're in your training, you're the leader, aren't you? To take responsibility and do something. And I wasn't sure how to do it without being kind of authoritarian. I didn't want to be authoritarian. I think what I let happen was I let the room decide it was unacceptable.
Yes.
Without me saying it. And this person, they were just oblivious to the impact they were having on everybody else. And I just...
It's coming back to that self-awareness bit again, isn't it? I think in the past when I've had that, not with laptops and stuff, but when somebody's been like on the phone and stuff, depending on the room, sometimes I have just said, would you like us to wait until you finished? You know, if it's been going on a while, and they go, oh, no, I'm really sorry. Or actually, yeah, no, this is really important. Okay, do you want to take it outside then so that we can focus on what we're doing rather than on what you're doing? Or sometimes, if they're repeat offenders, then I will walk around the room and just stand at the back of them while I'm still talking. So everybody's eyes is on me, but ultimately that person
looking through
realizes
them.
That.
That's a good technique.
And they realize then. But I'm quite happy to, I'm pausing here because I was going to say I'm quite happy to call people out on it. But this is something that you taught me in one of your posts quite a while ago now. I remember seeing this and it's always stuck with me. You did a post about not calling people out, but calling people in. And that's always stuck with me. And I really like that. And so I try and do that more and more. So I don't try and embarrass people and I don't try and make them feel as though they should know that what they're doing is either wrong or unacceptable, because they might not know. They might not be self-aware. There might be other things going on for them. So I try and do it in a way that, you know, allows them to feel as though they're not being told off and just making them feel more self-aware that actually what you're doing is distracting or what you've said isn't appropriate or, you know, but allowing them to learn from it rather than feel defensive.
Yeah, that's why I try and do the contract at the beginning. It's we all agree that we need to be present. We all agree that it's a good idea not to be distracted with other things. And we all agree that if you want to use the phone, you want to go to the toilet, you want to do anything else, you feel free. This is not primary school where you have to put your hand up and ask for permission. You just stand up and walk out and it's absolutely fine.
Yeah. But the words that you use there to describe that is the words that I use as well. It's about expectations. So what expectations do you have of what we're doing, of me, of your peers, rather than using the term ground rules? Because again, as soon as you start using that rules, we're limiting people.
Yeah.
Again.
But the group should decide. It shouldn't be me dictating. It should be the group. I mean, if the group said, look, actually, we're all trying to close a deal at the moment, and we're all on standby. And if the deal happens, we've all got to jump up and go and do something. I go, okay, it's going to be a rough ride, but I'll factor that into my meeting plan or my lesson plan, and I'll meet you where you're at. And
yeah,
you're paying me to be here.
Exactly.
You want me to do a great job. As long as you take away those key things, I may skip half the content because you're not listening and go straight to some action stuff where you have to be engaged because you're doing things.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, you have expectation setting.
Yeah. I've chaired so many board meetings where board members are sat around the table with their phones and their laptop and someone's giving a report and everyone's doing this on their own laptop, their eyes are down. And then when it's their turn for a report, they give their report and everybody else's eye down. Do you think half of you haven't paid attention to anything that's going on? And you look at questions at the end or people disagreeing with the minutes, you think, were you not there at the time? No, you weren't, actually. I remember you were sitting there writing your own personal emails while you were around the table.
Yeah.
And it is frustrating, that respect thing. You know, if you want people to listen to you, you need to give people their space. And that's that self-regulation, that emotional intelligence, understanding the room, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why I gravitated towards the Lego Serious Play that we spoke about earlier, was because as well as everybody having to build their own models in a proper structured session, I would then go around every single person and ask them to explain their model, how they see it. So there's no wrong answers. But also then I get the rest of the group to ask questions of the model. Not the whys, you know, no, why have you done that? But I see you've got a pink flower on the edge of your model there. What does that represent? So in order to ask those questions, you have to have listened to what the person says. Otherwise, you're asking a question about something that's already been said. And it does, and it drives deeper listening, but it also drives a deeper discussion. Because some people, even when they've built something, will go, well, I built this and it represents how I'm motivated on, you know, doing my work. And that's all they'll say. Some people will go into it very elaborately. But when you start asking questions about, well, what, tell me about that pink flower on the edge of the model, what does that represent? And even if they say, oh, I don't know, I just like the flower, you then follow it up with, well, now that I've pointed out, what might it represent? And they can give you an answer, and they always do. They'll say something like, well, actually, that's probably what I'm hoping it would be like, but it's right on the edge. It feels as though it's slightly out of reach. And you get these real deep insights into things, and the level of listening and contribution really shifts when you do something like that. rather than the standard. Has anybody got any questions? Yeah, and everybody goes, oh, okay, how close to lunchtime is it? I might not answer. Because it means we're going to be here for another 5 minutes and I'd rather go now. So yeah, it's interesting how you can shift the conversations along.
Yeah, one of the things I liked about the exercise I did with you, with my wife and others, was that initial phase where you're building and you're sharing a pile of Lego with somebody else, you're interacting with the person next to you who you may not know. It's also a very good bonding opportunity, and you're discussing, and you've broken that ice. And yes. in your one to your left, one to your right, and you're three. And if there's another three, you overlap, and it almost like infects around the tables. You start to have conversations. You're standing there queuing up to put your model on the mat. And again, you're like, oh, what's yours? Oh, what's yours? Where are you putting your one? And it again creates that. I'm going to use a puppy thing here. So when puppies meet, all they want to do is sniff each other's bums and run around in circles for 5 minutes. That's that. They want to bond and get to know each other. And I think sometimes when we're engaging in workshops and learning and development, we're not allowing people to do the bum sniffing. We're not allowing people to get to know each other and to get that human value. It's all me to you, not us and we.
Absolutely. But I think also there's an element of, so as a trainer or facilitator, allowing people, you know, giving somebody an activity that allows them to do that, allows then people to go, okay, right, it's I'm allowed to talk, I'm allowed to interact. I think sometimes when you go into a room, particularly if you don't know anybody else there, and you're not quite sure of the situation, then that can be hard just to strike up a conversation and go into small talk and try and engage and work out who's who. And, you know, it can be very intimidating, even in an in-house workshop where you know that there are going to be people in the room that you've worked with, but you don't really know them. And how's it going to work? And, you know, you need something at the beginning that just allows people to feel comfortable in just starting to talk. I think as a very young trainer, I expected that to happen just naturally. All these people would show up and nobody would talk. And I would almost be like, have you all lost your voices? And I look back at that now and think, how horrendous must that have been to be that person turning up who was probably a bit anxious and a bit worried about how it was going to work. Just, you know, to sit there and think, well, no, I haven't lost my voice, but I'm really, you know, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to interact with these people, or I don't want to. I don't actually want to be here, maybe, you know, all those things. So I think over my 30 odd years of being a trainer, I've learned an awful lot. And I do look back at those early years and think, oh, if only somebody had kind of steered me in a better direction in how to open up a workshop and make people feel more comfortable in that space.
I found that if you pounce on people cold, that makes people very nervous, very worried, because everyone's sitting around the table going, oh, going to pounce on me, avoid eye contact. Or sometimes, you know, I still do it, and I know I shouldn't maybe. You start and go around the table, so everyone's sort of think, oh, I've got time to think, what am I going to say?
Yeah.
And you've got to try and figure out who you start with, because you're thinking, okay, I've got to find the person who I think is going to be gung-ho for this. I'll find the extrovert. You might start with you and work around. But I've also found that if you ask people to introduce themselves to the person next door first.
Yeah.
So they're used to speaking out loud to somebody. And then once they've broken their duck, they've broken the ice on that, then they're happy to talk to the group because they've already their voice has already been heard once.
Yeah. One of the activities that I use quite a lot because it works quite well. And again, it does link to Lego. I keep going back to Lego a lot. I have a whole tub of deconstructed minifigures.
Right. Okay.
With lots of accessories. And I basically get people to build their own minifigure that represents themselves as, and whatever the topic is. So it's usually a leader or a manager, because that's you know, mainly what
Darth
I deal with.
Darth Vader with a lightsaber or something.
Well, actually, some people do, you know, but again, it's asking them, how does that represent you? And then depending on the size of the group, everybody introduces themselves to everybody, or they get into small groups and they introduce themselves. But it's about the representation. So, you know, that they might well have chosen something that looks like Darth Vader with a lightsaber. When you say to them, because how does that represent you as a leader? Then they have to think a little bit more.
Check people.
Yeah, I have a very commanding style of leadership. Okay, let's see how that plays out when we talk about leadership styles and stuff. Again, it gives something for somebody to do before they then start to talk, and they've got a prop there to be able to talk about So it feels a bit safer rather than just to say, hi, my name's Nikki. I think my leadership style is a bit like Darth Vader. I don't think anybody would actually say that if they didn't have a minifigure, you know, that they could construct into something with a lightsaber and stuff. But yeah, I think it's really interesting, those allowing people to feel comfortable in that opening part.
So how did you start your career then? You weren't always this superstar Lego deep learning specialist. Yeah. What was your ambition when you left school then?
So my ambition when I left school was to be a Radio 1 disc jockey. I wanted to be on the radio, and I did actually do a bit of time at hospital radio, which I loved. And I also did a bit of time at local radio. Radio Victory was the local radio station. Yes. Yeah.
Fratton Road. Yeah. Opposite the St. Mary's Church.
Yeah. It was. So I did several stints with what was called Victory FM. It came back as.
Yes.
And again, I loved it. It was a great experience. And I did a lot of presenting and producing and thought that could be a way forward. It really helped me learn how to talk to people in terms of interviewing and questioning. So I did something called Coffee on Victory FM. It was a morning stint where I used to get people in and interview them. So that was a big learning curve for me. But I soon realised if I wanted to do it professionally, there's way more rules and regulations and the certain things you're allowed to say and not allowed to say. And
yes.
And I kind of went off the ball a bit because I don't do rules very well. So I kind of deviated a bit. I didn't know what I wanted to do after that. So I started working at B&Q, very different from wanting to be on the radio, but it was just a part-time job. But actually, it was B&Q that allowed me to become a trainer in a very weird and wonderful way, because I was working on the decorative section and everybody was rag rolling their walls and crackle glazing anything that wasn't nailed down. And we had all these paint effects that came into the store and nobody knew how to use them. My manager at the time, knowing that I used to do the radio stuff, basically said, Nick, you know how to talk, go and demonstrate this stuff and get it sold. Okay. So I took myself off into a corner of the store and I was, you know, kind of trying to work out how to use it. And then people would turn up randomly and ask me what I was doing. And then that kind of evolved into me putting out some Tannoy announcements that I was going to do a demonstration. And then that escalated into me doing way more demonstrations on things. And I also became their interior designer for a while, quite randomly. But in true Nikki style, I didn't just want to be on the shop floor doing interior design. I decided that I was going to put on some evening classes for the customers to come in and do like a 6-week course on all this interior design stuff. I didn't even know I was training at that point. All I was doing was I didn't want to be on the shop floor. I wanted to do something else. And so the cafe, I was at Hedge End at the time when it just opened, the B&Q there, and they had a mezzanine floor with a cafe on it, which closed at 6. So from 6 till 8, every Thursday for about 6 weeks, I basically commandeered that and set up wallpaper trestle tables and had all this stuff going on. I had loads of people turn up, little certificates at the end of it. And it was through that somebody saw me and say, actually, you'd probably be quite good at doing induction workshops for us. So that's when I really got involved in doing what I'd call official training. I did induction workshops and became part of the team at B&Q and then became a management development person and then eventually became the regional training manager for the South, the little region that I was in. So I learned most of my formal training with B&Q in its, what I'd call its heyday of learning and development. And then everything else since then, it's different companies and different ways of doing things and just learning that every time you have different culture in the business or different people that want training to be a slightly different way. But all the time, the creative element has always followed me, just doing stuff that engages people to do things rather than me just studying in front of the room telling people stuff. So that's how I got into it.
Wow. So B&Q head office was, it used to be at Eastleigh, didn't it, at one time?
It did, yes. Yeah, I didn't go there very often, but it was just up the road.
But I know from hearing other stories that B&Q are an excellent inclusive employer, that they employ more people over the age of 60 than most. Yeah, they're really focused on developing people who are retired but useful.
Well, absolutely.
Or have a disability, employ lots of people with Downs, lots of people with learning disabilities, that they are a really inclusive employer.
Yeah. Certainly in the time that I was with them for 13 years, and certainly in the time that I was with them, I raved about B&Q. I really enjoyed their approach to employment and allowing people to better themselves, but also in a way that worked for them. It wasn't, you know, a hard line of this is how it's done.
Have you noticed a generational shift in how people want to engage in training? I mean, we hear that Gen Z, Gen Alpha, even younger millennials they want reward-based. I mean, we talked about puppies earlier. I mean, you need to keep feeding them treats. You know, people talk about gamifying and stimulating the brain chemicals to get people to be hyper and pumped up. Or do traditional training methods still work for the younger generation?
It's an interesting one. And I think I might struggle to answer that, because I think what I've always done is hits the dopamine.
Mm.
Because I've always had activities that get people to do the thing and get people to explore it and design it in a way that is quite short sections before we move on. But I do think, I've got a son who's 14, and I do recognise with him that the shorter, more interactive stuff will definitely sit better than, you know, any long form of learning. He talks about his teachers, and the ones that he likes the best are the ones that will engage in conversation, will set activities for them to do, rather than the kind of the drawn out side of things. So I noticed my speech has slowed down a bit, because I'm trying to think. And I see a lot of different generations in the work that I do. I mean, a lot of the stuff I do is around management and leadership. So it tends to be probably mid-30s upwards for most companies when I get involved in that. But I do a lot of stepping into leadership as well. And you tend to get younger generations in that. I do a lot of work with the NHS around leadership as mindset rather than leadership as a title. And I think that sometimes I see them turn up almost like, oh, I've got a full day of doing this, because they just used to being on their feet and doing stuff and things. But usually by the end of it, I've got a good thumbs up. And I think it's about engagement. I think it's always just been about treating people as they want to be treated, regardless of age.
The platinum rule. People often,
well, exactly.
People forget that. They always go for the golden rule, treat people as you want to be treated. But
yeah,
you've got to step into them. You've got to, person-centric. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you've got a group of people who are more quieter, more reflective, then you need to give them more time to reflect. If you've got a group of people that are all in, very loud and boisterous and wanting to, you know, kind of do everything at 100 miles an hour, then you might need to speed things up. But it's also looking for the outliers as well. You know, just because 90% of the room is that, you still need to make sure the 10% is allowed to, you know, get what they want from it as well.
And I suppose I actually want to have fun myself, you know, facilitating a group. I want to come out at the end of the day going, high five, I've enjoyed that. Yay, we've all bonded. I want you to think I've done a good job. So it's, you're trying to keep it active for yourself, because, you know, I don't know about you, but I've run the same course for an organization. I think I did something like 40 versions of this session to different cohorts over the course of 6 months. And by the end of it, you think, have I told that gag before? Have I said that? Did I tell you that, or did I tell the last group that? And it's like, by the end of it, your brain is like mush. So you want to enjoy it yourself, don't you? And I think the more you enjoy it, the more your audience are going to enjoy it as well.
Absolutely. And I think the way that I kind of get over that is by allowing more of the audience participation to come through, because then every session is different. You know, I think that there's always a structure to what you do, of course, and there's always key points that you want to get home. But when the audience is coming up with their answers and what happens next, and, you know, if we go off on a tangent, then fantastic, because that's what's needed in the moment. But you're right, at the end of it, you can usually tell if it's landed or not. I think for those people who are slightly more extrovert and vocal in how they're getting their learning, is very easy to read those. I think it's harder to read those that are slightly more reflective or internally thinking. And sometimes I do have to just verbally check how are we doing? Are we on the right level? Because I do find those sometimes slightly harder to read.
Yeah, it always surprised me because I tend to finish my sessions with tell me the one thing that is going to stick with you out of today's session, or the one thing you're going to implement right now.
Yes.
And go around the room and ask people to just verbalize that. And I think, wow, you picked up on that. Wow, you picked up on that. And the diversity of things that resonated with people, and it wasn't all the point I thought they were going to go for. They picked up something really random. I thought, wow, that was a throwaway remark I made an hour ago. And that really stuck with you. I thought, okay, that's brilliant. And so again, it's recognizing that everyone's going to take away something different and everyone hears something different. And everyone's situation is different, aren't they? So it's always surprising me. And I think it's really good because by sharing to the room what you're taking away, it gives other people those nuggets as well. So they're self-peer-to-peer learning again, aren't they? Oh, I'm taking this away because I'm taking that way. So it reinforces without me having to do a summary at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're absolutely spot on with that. The throwaway comment that wasn't in your design notes. You had no intention of saying it when you turned up in the morning. And that's the thing that they're taking away. It always makes me smile that. But that's the beauty of listening to the room and picking up on, what other people are saying and having the freedom as a trainer or facilitator to interject, and add stories that make sense for that moment. I think, just sticking to your script, well, no, that's what we've got, so that's what we'll do.
Mm.
That, it doesn't help. So I think it's great.
There's a technique, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called newsjacking. So what you're doing is you're taking current affairs or something of the moment and bringing that into the session as an anecdote or an example. Everyone's heard the news today, or everyone's aware of what's going on in the world. So if you ignore the Middle East, you ignore Russia, you ignore Iran, what's going on there at the moment, then you're ignoring the world. If you can bring some of those examples in, whatever that may be, and then it makes it completely of the moment and relevant.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think making it relevant is really important. I think also allowing people to work out for them in that moment, what's going on for them right now. Because quite often I get people turn up to management or leadership programs that aren't really managers or leaders, that they're perspective managers and leaders, and it's kind of allowing people to say, okay, this is what we're talking about now might not be something that you do for 6 months down the line. But actually, everything that I talk about is just people skills. So it can translate into talking with your peers, talking with suppliers, talking with stakeholders. I can't remember why I'm going off on this tangent now, but
I'm with you. I'm hanging in there.
Good.
I mean, I think what you're trying to say there is what you're trying to do is help people build a kit bag or a toolkit.
Yeah.
Of various things. If you're young, your toolkit's quite empty, but you get a couple of screwdrivers, you get a couple of spanners. And you think, I need to do this. I haven't got the right tool. I'll go and buy one of those from B&Q. And then you put it in your bag. And then later, a year later, you think, oh, I need that one again. And then you've got all that repertoire, those sayings, those thought processes.
Yeah. And then being able to reflect back on, I went to that workshop when we talked about that, right? Where's my notes about that? Or go and speak to somebody that was at the workshop before. I think that was another thing that I was going to bring up, actually, as you were talking about at the end of the day, where you said about what's the one thing you're taking away from today. So I'm a big fan of what I call distracted reflection.
Mm.
Not making full-on action plans at the end of a workshop. Because I don't believe that people have everything they need at the end of a workshop in order to say, this is definitely what we're doing going forwards. I think it's about giving people everything they need in a workshop to start the brain and allow the brain to digest it later down the line. Because when you say to people, right, come up with a really good idea right now, you've got 5 minutes, off you go. You might get one or two, but it's very unlikely. You're more likely to get that idea when you're walking the dog or, when you're sat reading something. Oh, no, that, oh yeah, I remember that. Well, that could work. It's always kind of in the moment. And so I'm really keen when I do my workshops to explain that to people, that at the end of this, you're not going to have a set of three action points that you have to take away and do by 3 months' time and then reflect back on them, because the brain doesn't work in that way. The brain works in a way that it needs time to mull it over and digest it and then work out, well, what am I doing with it? And it also takes the pressure off people as well, I think that they have to do those things. Particularly if somebody's, you know, quite anxious about, well, I've said I was going to do this and I really should be doing it, but I'm not going to have time to do it, or actually the plan's all changed.
Yeah, and people have to oscillate between operational and strategic thinking, don't they? It's like, what affects me today? What's my burning bridge? What's biting me on the backside right now? Versus if I invested the time to change the process or to enhance or to do things differently, I would do it this way in future, but I can't because that's stopping me. That's why I always tend to ask, what's stopping you? What prevents you from doing these things? And what's the most important thing you want to do? And hopefully in the room is generally a manager or a leader or a supervisor. They're hearing people say, well, this is what's stopping me. And I go, of course, time, money, all these kind of things are going to be stopping you. But what you should be saying is, nothing is the answer. What's stopping you? Nothing should be the answer. So what do you need your manager to do to allow it to be nothing? You know, what are the blockers is what I'm saying. And then let's get those out on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. Because as soon as one person says something, they go, oh, yeah, no. And it'll spark a conversation for something else. And it allows them to really delve down into what the challenge is rather than just the, I don't have time.
Oh, here's a tip for anyone listening. I've found that ChatGPT is really good at reading handwriting. So what I do is in my workshops, I get people to write on post-it notes. And so the four questions I ask is, what will I do? Will rather than should. Will I do? What will we do? What's the priority and what's stopping me? I get them to write on individual post-it notes and go around the room. And at the end of it, I take a photograph of all the post-it notes on my phone, in ChatGPT, and say, right, create me a spreadsheet with all the we's, I's, priorities and stoppings in a spreadsheet. I then feed that again back into ChatGPT and say, right, I want you to write me a delegate synthesis pack now with the 30, 60, 90-day follow-ups with all the key actions and all the key points and all the things that people were saying, summarized back, which I then send to the leader or the booker and say, this is what your cohort said. This is what their actions are. This is what they want to do about it. And this is what's stopping them.
And I like that.
Do you want to have a follow-up in 30 days? No one ever says, yeah, let's have a chat about this. They always take it. I have no idea if they read it. But it's a very easy way now of, I say, just take photographs and ChatGPT will do a good enough job on the handwriting.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be perfect. It's better than typing it in, because I used to sit on the train, typing it in, all the post-it notes, typing it in. Yeah, 2 hour train journey, I'd have them all done. But yeah, now photograph. I put them all on a whiteboard, take a photograph of the page, put them on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can turn this around in 20 minutes now.
Acts as a really good reminder of the day as well, because even if they don't do those things in 30, 60, 90 days, it will be a reflection of what their intentions were. Yeah. And I think that's really important to look back on.
And if someone does something with it, I don't need any gratitude. It was their work. You know, if the person that booked me as a trainer or a facilitator for the day, they take that away and go, oh, that was useful. If they take one thing out of it, that's fine. And they may never thank me. They may never come back to me. That's fine. At least they got the document. I know I've done a good job. You never know. They may refer you saying, oh, yeah, when Jo came in, she gave us this. This is fantastic. That's what you want. And it's part of the sales pitch as well. So you can just sort of offer it as your value add, isn't it? Your bonus content, if you like.
Mm.
So that's what I liked about your session. We got to keep the Lego. I was sort of thinking, I built my little model here. And I was thinking, this is really... He said, you can take your model away with you. Oh, what? Really? I've got my model. And it's that value. Yeah.
Yeah. I do tend to do that with the smaller bits of Lego. So as I said, when people build their minifigures at the beginning of a workshop, I always allow them to take it away. Because again, it acts as another little element in their brain to reflect back on what the day was, what it represented for them. Sometimes I bookend. So I get them to build their minifigure in the morning. They see themselves as a leader. And then at the end of the session, get them to add one accessory, having been through the workshop, that they now recognise about themselves as a leader or what they want to be in the future or whatever it is that we're doing. So they rummage around for another accessory and again, they go around and talk about it. So then they take it away and they end up putting it on their monitor or on the desk or even if they take it home and talk to the partner about it.
It's like a photograph, stick it on LinkedIn, tag you in, all that kind of
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly, all that stuff. But it's just an extra reminder. It's an extra little neuron in the brain that's connected somewhere that said, this is what we did on this workshop and this is what it meant for me. And that'll stick with them. It'll make it sticky for a lot longer.
We talked about inclusion and in the narrative, we also use the word belong. And all of these little techniques draw you in. This place is for me. I belong here. He's for me. Yeah, this training's for me. I've got something. I'm taking it away, and I feel that, as you say, the dopamine hits, the brain chemicals are firing off, and you come away going, "Oh, that was really good." So you have a positive experience of the whole thing. It's what you're after, isn't it?
Yeah. Because if somebody's had a positive experience, they're much more open to learning. That's ultimately what I'm gearing it for. Is if they feel comfortable in the space and they feel comfortable with how to express themselves, they are much more likely to retain the learning that they've had, and that then becomes much more worthwhile in terms of somebody having employed me to deliver, but them in terms of having spent their time in term and turning up.
Are you able to translate this into online, or are you more a face-to-face person?
I prefer face-to-face, definitely. I do some programs online. And I usually send out a workshop pack if it's something like I don't tend to do days, I tend to do programs, shorter sessions over a period of week. And so in the past, what I've done is I've sent out a workshop pack where I've actually had some form of activity that I want them to do, but I've put it in almost like a party bag, like a little paper bag that I've sealed down with a sticker on it. This is workshop one. So everybody, we're all online, right? Everybody get your pack, your little parcel for workshop one. And so again, dopamine, we're all opening up. What is this? Opening it up, and there's something in there. That it may be a deck of cards. It may, and so, they're going through those, or it may be a bit of Lego that they have to build. It could be anything, but again, it allows it to be more than just, we're just on the camera and the microphone and talking, and I want to go off and get a cup of tea, or I'm just distracted by the dog or something. It's getting them physically involved, but also the excitement of, I've got these little presents that I'm going to open up on each session. So that's how I tend to play it if I'm doing online stuff.
I think that's what impressed me about the session that you ran, that I was a part of, is the amount of forethought and prep and stuff that was. It wasn't just you stood up with a slide deck and talked. There was clearly so much depth there of the materials you produced. And as I always said, that these are custom stuff you've designed, these pull these together. And that's not cheap to pull together either, is it? You must have invested quite reasonably in the card, decks of cards, the Lego you give away, the mats and stuff. You must have.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of money.
Some of this stuff I've designed specifically for me to use, but some of it I design and then sell to other trainers as well.
Yeah.
So it has like an ongoing effect. But the Lego, I think it's not that expensive at the end of the day. And for the value that it gives in terms of the experience.
Well, minifigures, £2.50 or thereabouts, isn't it? So one minifigure.
Not if you buy pre-loved minifigures.
Pre-loved, okay, off eBay. Yeah.
I'm all for recycling and upcycling and that kind of stuff. So good old eBay gets quite a lot of my business.
Yeah.
And I get all sorts. And you can get all sorts on there and just give them a little bit of a wash and stuff. And they're perfectly good for reusing.
Stick them in the dishwasher in a bag or something, yeah.
Well, yes. Yeah, that's a good one to do. But yeah, I think it doesn't matter whether it's half an hour or, a six-part program. I think the same effort should be put into that experience for both of those.
Well, I do that. I produce laminated cards, A6, A5, little tiny ones. I have props. I have lots of videos, which I've curated over the years, and little games I do. So yeah, I even turn up with a crate full of fidget toys and baskets. I always provide pens and pen holders. I've got sweets. I've got gluten-free, vegan-compatible sweets, which I give out.
Yeah.
this coffee biscuit. So I turn up and I spend 15 minutes to get the room ready. And then when people walk in, they go, wow. It's like, oh, you can see them eating the sweets, eating the biscuits. You think, yeah, this is kind of, people are eating, they're enjoying, they're settled down. They're sitting there with the fidget toys. Yeah, help yourself to the fidget toys.
Absolutely. And it tells people as soon as they walk into the room, it tells them that they've been thought about.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned about the gluten-free and the vegan aspect of things. The amount of time I've turned up to a hotel to run a workshop and they've got the biscuits out and you say, okay, where are the gluten-free ones? Where are the dairy-free ones? Oh, no, we don't have any of those. Good job, I bought some then. You know, because it's... my husband is gluten-free and dairy-free, so I know that every time he goes to it, there's never anything for him. And lunch is always just a salad.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, that's not the same experience. So it's the small things that I think really do make the biggest difference for people.
A number of times I've turned up for lunchtime buffets and things, and you see all of this stuff, and then at the end, there's this one plate with a bit of cling film over it that's got vegan or dairy-free on it. You think, really? We've got all this lovely colour and appetising food here, and we've got this plate of mush at the end, which is like... And I just think it's so sad. You know, my reaction would be, start with that. Everyone has vegan or everyone has gluten-free or whatever, and then have your meat pile that you can add to it or something. So if you make it all special for everybody, and then you can add the meat or you can add the gluten. And people should engineer it in reverse.
Yes.
Include something for everybody that you can then upgrade if you need to.
Absolutely.
And have gluten-free upgrades as well. Yeah, have something yummy and exciting. Yeah. Yeah. That's conscious inclusion for you though, isn't it? We know about that. Yeah.
Is I think that's when you find out whether a company is driven by profit or not, because gluten-free, dairy-free quite often is more expensive. But when you think about it, natural foods tend to be gluten-free. You know, I think it's just about making the experience good for everybody.
Yeah, it is. And that's where we started. You know, we talk about person-centric. You know, you can't have one size fits all, because do you want to be the person that's not thought about? You're going to switch off. You're going to be disruptive. You're going to be unattentive. You're going to be fidgety. And that vibe will spread around the room as well.
Yeah, it will. It gets picked up very quickly.
Nikki, it's been absolutely fascinating. I've loved talking to you, and I can't wait to meet for a coffee sometime. I'm sure we'll bump into each other somewhere.
Yes.
How can people get hold of you?
So the best way is via my website, which is curiouslighthouse.co.uk. Everything is on there, from the management development stuff to the Lego Serious Play workshops. But LinkedIn is also where I hang out as well. And if they're looking for me, it's Nikki, which is spelled N-I-K-I-E, just to be different. Forster, F-O-R-S-T-E-R. So yeah, LinkedIn or my website are the two best places to get hold of me.
Fabulous. And you talked earlier about having aspirations to be on the radio, and that you probably weren't radio friendly enough. And I was thinking, as I was talking just then, that bum sniffing wasn't a phrase I was expecting to say today. And it probably isn't a phrase you could broadcast on breakfast radio or something. So, yeah, I'm with you. My brain slots things into my mouth that I don't necessarily filter sometimes.
It's a good job that we've got this as a way of being able to voice ourselves without those rules. And
it's all right. We can broadcast our own radio.
Indeed.
Nikki, thank you so much. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on, Joe.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.